Elizabeth Strout and Marilyn Robinson are two of America's most acclaimed novelists. Strout just won the Pulitzer Prize for her book Olive Kitteridge, a series of connecting stories about the cantankerous and rather complicated olive of the title. Marilyn Robinson's most recent novel, Home, was a finalist for the National Book Award, and like her previous novel, Gilead, which won the Pulitzer Prize, it delves into religious ideas like sin and salvation. Steve Paulson talked with both Strout and Robinson before a live audience at the Wisconsin Book Festival. Steve was curious about why both writers have set their recent books in small towns. Here's Elizabeth Strout.
I keep going back to the New England towns in my fiction because I was raised there, and I've lived in New York for 25 years, and I think that I've lived with a constant low-level sense of homesickness, so I keep going back in my fiction with a sense of yearning. But I also am very interested in the sense of place.
So if you've been living in New York City for 25 years, why haven't you set any books there?
I am. I'm starting. I promise. It's happening. I'm crawling down the East Coast with my work.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of your fiction has been set in small towns in New England. Of course, Marilyn, your last two books have been set in a small town in Iowa. What is it about small towns that seems to be such a rich fictional backdrop?
It's a more controllable world in a certain sense. You know, I mean, if you set something in a city, you have to acknowledge the scale of it, I think. And a small town is a small model of life in a certain sense, you know. I grew up in a very small town in the Northwest, and I think that the difference that people try to make between small towns and large cities in terms of, you know, how it feels to live there, I think that that's exaggerated, that you actually can use a town to mean something much larger than itself.
Hmm. I think what interests me about small town life is the sense that people think they know about other people, and to some extent they do. You live in a town with somebody for your lifetime or for many, many years. Of course you know certain facts about them. So there's that illusion that everybody knows everybody's business, but we don't. One doesn't. We never know what it's like to be another person. So that's fascinating to me as a writer.
Aren't there some other issues that tend to come up in stories about small town life? I mean, the importance of keeping up appearances, for instance, how gossip and rumor can really change people's lives.
Yes, I think that element is larger. One of the things that I like about living in New York City is that to some extent, you can walk down the street almost naked and nobody cares. They just don't care. And that's very freeing to me. And there are perhaps small towns where you could do the same and nobody would care, but it's only because they understand that that's you, you're going to walk down the street. Big difference.
Doesn't Maine also have a reputation for having eccentric and kind of cantankerous people?
Well, if it doesn't, it probably should. Mostly I think of them as being taciturn. There's a great sense of not speaking when one doesn't need to. Which is why I think I had to leave.
Following up on this notion of Maine and New England character, I want to get a sense of your central character in your book, Olive Kitteridge. She is the character who keeps reappearing in your stories. And I'd love to have you read a passage from, I was thinking about one of your stories, A Little Burst. And there's a scene where Olive's only child, her son Chris, has just got married to a doctor named Suzanne, and Olive is resting in an upstairs room, and she overhears a conversation that her new daughter-in-law is involved in. Could you read that for us?
Sure. Let me just mention she's actually resting on her son's bed. The screen door opens and closes again. Someone has gone in. Olive sits up, her nap spoiled. Now a softer voice comes through the window. So, Susie, how do you like your new in-laws? Olive's heart goes beat, beat as she sits on the edge of the bed. It's interesting, Suzanne says, her voice lowered and serious. Dr. Sue, the professional about to give a paper on intestinal parasites. Her voice drops and Olive can't hear. I can see that. Murmur, murmur. The father. Oh, Henry's a doll. Olive stands up and very slowly moves along the wall closer to the open window. A shaft of the late afternoon sun falls over the side of her face as she strains her head forward to make out words in the sounds of the women's murmuring. Oh, God, yes, says Suzanne, her quiet words suddenly distinct. I couldn't believe it. I mean that she would really wear it. The dress, Olive thinks. She pulls herself back against the wall. Well, people dress differently up here. By God, we do, Olive thinks. He's had a hard time, you know, Suzanne says, and being an only child, that really sucked for him. The expectations, you know. Olive turns and gazes slowly around the room, her son's bedroom. She built it, and there are familiar things in here, too, like the bureau and the rug she braided a long time ago. But something stunned and fat and black moves through her. He's had a hard time, you know. Almost crouching, Olive creeps slowly back to the bed, where she sits down cautiously. What did he tell Suzanne? A hard time. She hears Suzanne say something about her guests, and then the screen door slams, and it is quiet in the garden. Olive touches her open palm to her cheeks, her mouth. She's going to have to go back into that living room before somebody finds her in here. She will have to bend down and kiss the cheek of that bride, who will be smiling and looking around with her know-it-all face. Oh, it hurts. Actually makes Olive groan as she sits on the bed. What does Suzanne know about a heart that aches so badly at times that a few months ago it almost gave out, gave up altogether? Her son came to her last Christmas time before any Dr. Sue was on the scene and told her what he sometimes thought about. Sometimes I think about just ending it all. An uncanny echo of Olive's father 39 years before, only that time newly married, with disappointments of her own and pregnant, too, but she hadn't known that part then. She said lightly, oh, Father, we all have times when we feel blue. The wrong response, as it turned out. Olive, on the edge of the bed, leans her face into her hands. She can almost not remember the first decade of Christopher's life, although some things she does remember and doesn't want to. She tried teaching him to play the piano and he wouldn't play the notes right. It was how scared he was of her that made her go all wacky. But she loved him. She would like to say this to Suzanne. She would like to say, listen, Dr. Sue, deep down there is a thing inside me, and sometimes it swells up like the head of a squid and shoots blackness through me. I haven't wanted to be this way, but so help me, I have loved my son.
Thank you. Now, we might add that Olive does get her revenge.
She does.
You'll have to read the story to see how that happens. Now, was it hard to inhabit this character of Olive throughout the story? Because she's often not that nice a person.
It was frighteningly not that difficult. She was a strong enough character that she appeared pretty fully formed. And my only job in writing her was to consistently tell myself, don't be careful, don't be careful, don't protect her, just let her be Olive.
I have to say, one of the pleasures for me of having the two of you up here together is I think both of you have done something really unusual, and that's you've written about ministers and people who take religion really seriously, and not in the kind of stereotypical way that, you know, usually a preacher shows up in a novel. These are not hypocrites. These are not comical figures. These are people who have really serious religious ideas. Elizabeth, you did that in your earlier book, Abide With Me. And Marilyn, of course, you've done this with your two most recent books, Gilead and Home. And Marilyn, what is it about ministers that you like to write about?
Well, I like theology. And certainly the question of what goes into the experience of understanding life, of attempting to live well, you know, attempting to understand the reality of other lives. I think that those are deeply religious concerns for people who think in religious terms.
So the whole question of what it means to live a moral life is very meaningful, certainly to your characters, I'm guessing to you as well.
You know, I hate to admit it, but I'm a little disturbed by the word moral because it's used so judgmentally, you know? And it seems to me as if the actual morality of almost any circumstance is complex. It's always a new question. And that the thing to be retrieved out of it is the idea of what is good.
Elizabeth, what about you? Why did you write a book about a minister?
Well, just to follow up on the word morality, I tend to have a similar feeling as that. I think how we live matters, and that we have to deal with that ourselves on a daily, disciplined kind of basis. I was very interested in writing about a minister because, first of all, what interests me most is the impulse that gives rise to our need to find religions or to have developed religions. I was also very, very interested in the question of whether or not compassion is a luxury, and how far can any of us go in accepting someone else's pain and being generous toward that before we stop.
Marilyn, could you give us a taste from your book, Home? And I was thinking of, there's a scene when Glory, who is a very pious woman, she has come home to take care of her ailing father, and her older brother has also shown up after many long years of being away, and Jack is this rather troubled character. At one point, the two children are chatting, and he asks her, half-jokingly, well, are you going to try to save my soul? Could you read that passage?
All right. Maybe she kept the Bible out of sight because she was afraid that if he spoke to her that way again, she would have to tell him she had no certain notion what a soul is. She supposed it was not a mind or a self, whatever they are. She supposed it was what the Lord saw when his regard fell upon any of us. But what can we know about that? Say we love and forgive and enjoy the beauty of another life, however elusive it might be, then presumably we have some idea of the soul we have encountered. That is what her father would say. Even her father's sermons treated salvation as a thing for which they could be grateful as a body, as if for their purposes at least, that problem had been sorted out between the Druids and the Centurions at about the time of Hadrian. He did mention sin, but it was rarefied in his understanding of it, a matter of acts and omissions so commonplace that no one could be wholly innocent of them or especially alarmed by them either. She did remember once, when Ames was at dinner years earlier, his mentioning to her father that a local man, unchurched, noted for bursts of rage and for a particular hostility toward children, his own included, had come to the parsonage at midnight to consider his soul. Ames had said, "It's like a bad tooth. It acts up when everybody else is sleeping, and it's not the kind of problem you want to deal with by yourself." And they had laughed together, quietly. Who could know what they knew, what restive hearts had opened to them, how many midnights had brought the sleepless to their doors? She should ask Jack what a soul is, since he seemed to feel the presence of a soul. Cankered, perhaps, but that was what gave him his awareness of it. Either of those prayerful old men, Ames or her father, could probably tell her too, but it was late to put such a question to them. Jack would laugh at her and tease her, which would be much preferable to their sober, gentle surprise.
Thank you. Well, let me ask a more personal question here. Do those religious ideas of sin and salvation mean something to you?
These questions are so difficult. Yes, and I don't know what they mean. It would be... I mean, as I approach theology, and I think it's a respectable enough approach, I think that these words raise questions.
But it's, I mean, a lot of people would just as soon throw out the whole notion of sin. I mean, those who are not very religious, you don't want to do that. I mean, that's you're saying it raises questions. There may not be obvious answers, but it raises important questions.
Yes. I think one of the things that is unfortunate is that the idea of sin has been trivialized so that it's like associated with promiscuity or something like that. When in fact, you know, when we injure the circumstances of one another's lives, we sin. I think that's an important category that has to be retained. And frankly, by trivializing the idea and the word, we have made ourselves poorer in terms of the likelihood of our being able to describe and understand real injury that we do, important injury.
That's Marilyn Robinson, author of the novels Home and Gilead, talking with Steve Paulson at the Wisconsin Book Festival. They were joined by Elizabeth Strout, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, Olive Kitteridge,